Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm William English, and today's guest is avant-garde filmmaker and writer Nikki Hamlin. The following is from a recent mail out regarding a screening next week at Wilton's Music Hall. More of this later. Professor Nikki Hamlin studied fine art at Reading University and has made over 40 films, videos and installations since then. His films have been shown at festivals and screenings around the world, and his book Film Art Phenomena was published by the BFI in 2003. He is presently senior lecturer in video arts production and visual theory at the University for the Creative Arts Maidstone and a visiting lecturer at the Royal College of Art. His recent work has been concerned with exploring and trying to refine the relationship between the camera and its pro-filmic. Good afternoon, Nikki. Thank you very much for coming in.
Oh, thank you for asking me. It's very flattering.
I don't think so. After that CV, sounds quite proper.
Yeah.
At the end of that, are you happy with the description avant-garde, experimental, or do you just call yourself a filmmaker?
Yeah, I mean, they are problematic terms, I suppose, but in one sense, it identifies an area of practice which is distinct from cinema and things like that. So to that extent, it's useful.
Yeah.
I mean, there are long kind of debates about whether avant-garde is still a useful term or not. But
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, artist filmmaker might be just as good, if not better, actually.
Yes, that in itself is a kind of, I suppose, artist filmmaker is itself a problem, isn't it? Because
it is.
Of the history of artist filmmakers, as it were.
Yeah.
Which sort of goes back to maybe the 60s. But I mean, film, that was actually going to be one of my sort of later questions, which is about the idea of film art or filmmaker. There are artists' films, aren't there? Such as we see at the moment, sort of just about everywhere. Do you still see a separation, or maybe this isn't an issue for you at all? I mean, perhaps you don't see any division between the two.
Well, no, I think, there certainly is a division in terms of the histories, and, you know, while there have been very interesting artists like Bruce Nauman, Robert Morris, people who've made kind of interesting work, there is also that kind of proliferation of artists using film, mostly video, but also now increasingly film, funnily enough,
yes,
in galleries. But that's a distinct area of activity. I think it's still distinguishable from the kind of filmmakers' co-op tradition that goes back to films like Ballet Mécanique in the 20s and through the London Filmmakers' Co-op and other filmmakers' co-ops. And although various people have written about the overlap and the crossover, and people like Warhol, you know, in a way, in a sense, occupying both camps.
Yeah, I mean, Ballet Mécanique, that's Léger, isn't it?
Yeah,
who obviously was a fine artist himself, but probably didn't present Ballet Mécanique as a work of artist's film so much as they were more interested in the cinema at that time, weren't they?
Yeah, I think. Those films were so occasional, really, and within his practice.
Yeah.
A lot of those artists that made films then, I'm not sure what they would have been consciously relating it to, but certainly, you can see how Ballet Mécanique relates to other aspects of Léger's work. I'm not sure to what extent he was very consciously thinking about the cinema when he was making films like that. But I imagine it's an anti-cinematic film in the sense that it has this little clip from a romantic shot of a woman on a swing, which kind of represents the popular movies of the time, and then it deliberately subverts that by turning that shot upside down and then using repetition and things like that. So it clearly turns away from cinema. It says, here's cinema, and now this is what we're going to do.
Right.
And then we're going to move away from it. So I suppose to that extent, actually, it does position itself as anti-cinema, and that's something that crops up repeatedly, you know, with people like, well, Peter Godal is an obvious example, somebody whose theory is very much based around an opposition to cinema, a critique of cinema.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose in his case, it's pretty much an opposition to everything.
Well, yeah.
Sort of oppositional practice, even to the extent of being almost against the avant-garde, or certainly against certain...
Pretty much,
90% of what the avant-garde...
Absolutely, Godard, and even the kind of experimental political films that are made in the 70s by people like Peter Wallin and Laura Mulvey, those, and in a way, especially those.
Yeah.
But I was going to say that there will be... I'll be showing one of Peter Godard's shorter films in the Wiltons Music Hall event, which you referred to at the beginning. Quite a short film. I'm showing it mostly because it's short. Most of his films are a bit too long to show in this program.
Is that Room Film or Room
Film? No, this is called Room Film 73. No, that's about 50 minutes. This film is called Epilogue. It's only 7 minutes long.
Oh, right. Yeah,
but it does the job very well for kind of setting out his position, you know, and for all the theorizing that he does, the films are very. They really do what he wants them to do. Which is to really kind of make you question what you're seeing and to ask questions about perception and what kind of perception film is involved with in distinction to, say, painting and drawing, for example. I think that's what's kind of very interesting about them.
Yeah. So he was obviously an influence on you, do you think?
Yeah. I mean, when I was a student, he came and showed Room Film 1973, which I think is still a kind of seminal film in his kind of body of work.
Yeah.
And it was... I mean, some students walked out, others got very angry.
Where was this?
At Reading University.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And, but I, then he talked, and I was kind of aware at the time of problems in a way between the relationship between the films, the film as one experienced it, and the theory. But what I liked about the talk he gave was that it was this kind of anti-cinema polemic, and I sort of identified that with that because I'd had similar misgivings myself about the cinema, the experience of being manipulated emotionally.
Hmm.
I suppose I, up until that point, I'd been an impressionable teenager until relatively recently. And a lot of what he said just chimed and kind of articulated what I'd felt myself from going to cinema, you know, having this rather uneasy relationship with it.
Right.
And it's taken me a long time to kind of work that through, and I don't think my own work has ever been Godardian in that sense, but the theory and the kind of the work have been very influential.
I think it's kind of your own work is probably, I would say, sort of it's only Godardian in the sense that it's extremely rigorous and methodical and pared down. I suppose it's what you eliminate to a great extent. A lot of it is about what you're not doing. As much as what you are doing.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you said that because the first thing you experience when you look through the viewfinder of a cine camera, in my case it was a Super 8 camera, so the experience was particularly pronounced, but you're very aware of what you're not seeing when you look through the viewfinder, as you know, as a filmmaker yourself. And I think I suddenly thought, yes, this is... I didn't articulate it like this at the time, but it's a very editorial, it's a heavily editorial process. It involves a paring away. And then you have to think really carefully about, well, what's going to be in the frame? And I think I kind of latched onto that quite early on. I mean, I think some of the films have been maybe a bit more florid than you described, but in terms of, especially more recently, the way they're structured is quite meticulous anyway.
Yeah.
If not rigorous.
Yeah, no, I certainly think of them as rigorous.
Mm.
And your approach to writing is also very, very methodical.
Mm.
The Film Art Phenomena book is a very good survey of the scene.
Mm.
Now, you were studying art at Reading, in the 1970s.
Yeah,
and were you studying painting at the time?
Yeah, painting. I went there to paint, and I suppose the first year it was a very traditional course. We used to do colour mixing exercises and things like that, but then and some of the students were kind of got stuck into that. But then at the same time, there were people like Anne Bean was a student there. Anne Bean,
really?
Who went on to found the Beau Gamelin.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were a number of people doing performance art, and I'd never encountered this before, you know, having come from a boarding school, done art A-level, and had this very kind of narrow experience, even though I'd been to the Tate and seen Robert Morris's felt sculptures and so on. So that there was this other activity going on. The tutors weren't so happy with it, but I thought, oh, this is very exciting, you know. And then Ron Hazelden, who was then really a sculptor, but he went through a filmmaking phase, happened to be teaching there, happened to be making films when I was there, and I just kind of accidentally got involved in a project that he was running, and all my film came out. It was, the exposure was all okay. I'd done photography as a boy, you know, I'd had a little darkroom at home and done contact prints and stuff, so I knew how it worked. And did a film, and that all came out, and I thought, well, this is exciting. Now what do I do with it, you know? And that was kind of the starting point. And so the first few films I made were abstract films using just geometric shapes, shot frame by frame, like animations, really.
Is it 16mm?
Actually, on unsplit standard 8 film. So using a standard 8 camera, but they're not splitting the film, so you get four frames within the 16mm frame.
Yeah.
And then projecting them as 16mm. And I did three or four films like that, and that culminating in a four-loop film, which had diagonal crosses which flashed on and off at different rates, and the projectors are actually moved around to create different configurations while the film is running. And so it's a kind of live, a kind of performance thing which lasts about 20 minutes.
Right. When was this?
That was done in 1974.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that sounds pretty radical for the time, actually.
Yeah, I was quite pleased with myself.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought, this is great. I'm actually, I felt like I was making some progress, you know, because I'd done the unsplit standard 8 films and then the loop. But then the next film I made, which is also showing at the Wiltons event, kind of went back to, if you like, proper filmmaking, using a camera to look at the world and then creating material and trying to decide how to structure it.
Right.
So that was then almost like a new beginning. And I had to sort of think again completely about how long does a shot last. I never really thought about that. I hadn't even thought about editing. I just filmed the film and thought, oh, that's it. And then, of course, when you look at the rushes, you think, oh, well, hang on, it's much too slow. That, you know, and then you're pitched into editing.
Yeah.
It was all quite a shocking experience in a way.
Well, my first camera was also a standard 8. I had a Bolex standard 8, which, strangely enough, by coincidence, I bought in Reading.
Oh, right.
Because I lived in Reading for a while.
Right.
And I remember going to Reading University when they had one of those Bruce Lacey rituals. Do you remember that? In the sort of garden there.
Yeah.
So they had some strange sort of event going on.
Yeah.
And Bruce Lacey came on and did this sort of like Native American ritual or something.
Yeah.
Sort of like shaking, you know, instruments and so on.
That would have been Art Exchange, which was this wonderful kind of arts kind of club thing that I ran it myself for 2 years, and then someone else took it over after me. And yeah, we'd get people in like Bruce Lacey. I think Lacey came through Ron Hazelden. I think Ron Hazelden knew Bruce Lacey, possibly.
Right.
But yeah, we had all sorts of people. We had Genesis Peoridge, and you know, I got into trouble with him because he came down with Cozy Fanny Tutti, and they did a kind of performance which involved filling the ashtrays in the student union, filling them up with tomato ketchup.
All right.
And the cleaners weren't very happy about that.
Right.
Dear idea. Yeah.
So did you just kind of, did you abandon painting then and think, right, this is it, I'm going to be a filmmaker?
Pretty much. It was, I got to the end of the first year, and then in the second year there were some structured projects, and I did some kind of Robert Morris-influenced sculptural things, which also involved a little bit of video, because we had access to video equipment through the education department, which is in the same campus in London Road, the old campus in London Road in Reading, which we shared with microbiology and food science, actually.
Okay.
There were some collaborations, actually, between microbiologists and art students, but... Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was... where was I? Yes, I've lost my thread now.
That's all right. Don't worry. I can remember... I remember they actually were one of the few places that had one of those incredible high-speed cameras. Do you remember that? Because when I was in Reading, I remember sort of trying to hang around the place and sort of saying, can I borrow this camera sometime? And they wouldn't let me use it. But it's one of those that shoots about 1,000 frames a second.
Oh, yeah. Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which could have tied in with the microbiology, I suppose.
Quite possibly, yeah. Yeah.
But you made a film called Silver Street, didn't you?
That's the film I was talking about just now, in a way. Without,
oh,
I
didn't, is that the one?
Didn't title it, but right. That was the film that, which is showing at Wilton's, which,
right.
Where I was living on a street called, it was called Silver Street, and then it was Mount Pleasant, it became Silver Street, or vice versa. It was actually the Basingstoke Road.
It
was quite a busy road, and I had a room above an old Georgian shop, which overlooked the road. And I just became aware of the fact that, you know, I had this, in a way, my bedroom adjacent to this very busy road. And I suppose I just started thinking about the contrast between the street and the room, and you know, just developed, the film developed out of that dichotomy, really. But right. the fact that the windows were like sort of membranes or screens, if you like, between the two spaces, that all that the only thing that separated the spaces in a way was glass. And so the film developed out of that, and then I had to think about, well, a structure for the film. Right. So it started off as a kind of almost like a diary, day in the life kind of thing. But then I gradually tightened the structure up so that I shot every hour on the hour from early in the morning till late at night,
right.
filming inside and outside, intercutting between the two. And then the film has quite a metric kind of rhythm, quite a rigorous rhythm to it, because we didn't really have any editing equipment at Reading. All we had was a projector and some rewind arms and a splitter. Right. So the only way I could really edit was to put the film on the projector, watch it, make notes. And in the end, I realized that if I kept on doing that, I'd just destroy the film. So what in the end I did was just calculate lengths and measured them off and cut the film. It's a little bit more to it than that, but the editing definitely reflects this kind of the fact that I didn't have a Steenbeck or a Pixink to do the editing on. But then, I mean, people have made films with cameras without viewfinders as well. I mean, Peter Kubelka did that with one of his films, Shrekatar, I think. It's made with a camera with no viewfinder.
Really? Yeah. Oh, right. Yeah.
I'm not quite sure how he lined up the shots, but anyway.
Yeah. So then you sort of progressed sort of through the co-op scene, didn't you? You joined the London Filmmakers Co-op. Yeah. You were on the editorial board of Undercut, the co-op magazine.
Yeah.
And then you've written for Art Monthly and so on, and now this film art phenomenon, which came out a few years ago.
Yeah.
Yes, I meant to ask you. You had a brief period as a roadie, didn't you?
I did.
Where does that appear in this CV?
Richard Boone, who was a painting student in my year at Reading, and he's now a librarian in Stoke Newington, and he crops up in Ian Sinclair's new book actually, because he realised that Ian Brakewell lived in Albion Drive, Stoke Newington, and Ian Sinclair lived in Albion Drive, Hackney.
Okay.
Anyway, Richard was a friend of Howard Devoto, who was in the original Buzzcocks lineup, and then Howard left and formed Magazine. And then after Richard graduated, he went back to Manchester, he was actually originally from Leeds, but he moved back to Manchester and became the Buzzcocks manager, just learned on the job, really. And because I had an HGV license,
which you just happened to pick up,
I did,
along the way.
Yeah. Well, it was a kind of career plan kind of idea.
Oh, right.
That I thought, wouldn't it be a good idea to have a useful skill that I can earn money with, you know,
right.
while I build my career as an artist? I mean, it didn't really work out like that. And lorry driving is very badly paid, I think. Well, it certainly was then. But he rang me up and said, would I drive the equipment for their tour, their first national tour, which was in 1978, to promote the first album. So I was there roadie for a month. And there was also an abortive tour to Ireland because the minibus broke down on the M6, so we never got to Stranraer to get the ferry to Belfast. So, yeah.
Okay. So that was your life as a roadie for the Buzzcocks?
Yes, it didn't last very long.
Right, right.
I'd also, at the time, I was working as a projectionist at the Electric Cinema, and I had to lie to them, actually, to take the time off. I was off for this job, and I thought, yeah, I want to do this.
This is a public confession now.
It is. Yeah. I rang the Electric Cinema up and told them that I had a hernia. I don't know why I did that. It's kind of idiotic, delinquent sort of thing that I sometimes have done.
Right.
So they didn't ask me back after that. It was a horrible place to work, actually. But anyway, strange place to work, because the projectors... Yeah. One of the previous projectionists had been Reg Christie, the Rillington Place murderer.
No.
At the Electric, yeah.
Oh, wow.
And the projectors had belonged to Winston Churchill previously.
Right.
They came from Chartwell.
Okay.
And they were carbon arc projectors. So we're getting off the point a bit.
No, well, it's all fascinating.
Carbon
stuff.
Arc lamp projectors, which instead of having a bulb in, they have two carbon arcs, and the current arcs across the carbon rods inside.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's completely open. It's just a metal housing. And that the rods burn away, and the electricity arcing across the rods creates this very intense, wonderful light, actually. I mean, this, you know, if you see a Technicolor, an original Technicolor nitrate film projected on carbon arc projectors, which is very dangerous because of the... It looks very different to a modern print on a Xenon projector.
Right.
But the manager used to come up, and he used to switch the projector on for a few seconds and then switch it off and then light his cigarette on the... from the glowing end of the carbon rod. Right. He used to call it the most expensive cigarette lighter in the world.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because I was at the Pompidou Centre last week, and there was an installation by a guy called Philippe Parrino.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, there seems to be a lot of this about now. There was also a Rodney Graham exhibition with, 35 millimeter projectors in the gallery, like two of them. But this Parrino seems to have kind of upped the ante a bit.
Mm.
And he's got a 70 millimeter projector in the gallery, completely housed in a sort of dustproof glass casing with, air extraction ducts and the whole thing, projecting like an 8-minute loop. And it's just electric shutters that go up and down to black out the windows. And but there seems to be more and more of this kind of it's almost projectors as sculpture or something.
Yeah, Rodney Graham has done. Did you mention? Did you
yes,
just mention Rodney
yeah,
Graham?
Yeah. Yes. At the Listen Gallery in Whitechapel, I think he had quite a lot of sort of things, installations, I suppose, where the projector sort of figures almost more than the film, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah, it's as if these people suddenly discovered this technology and they're kind of bowled over by it. I mean, I find it a bit slight, really, and I don't really. It's like they found the projector and then thought, oh, I've got to make a piece of work that uses this, and I mean, that's so other to the way that the co-op filmmakers work, which was just kind of they knew about that technology and then they would kind of interrogate it and think, well. We know what this does. It has an ideological function, and we're going to try and take that apart. Whereas, in a way, these like the Perena things, that sounds like a kind of fantastic fetishization of the technology.
Yes.
Really,
I think at the co-op cinema. I remember taking a friend of mine there to a screening, and he thought that the whole cinema there was like an apparatus. He felt like he was inside. The technology somehow.
Oh, that's brilliant.
At the co-op, because it was all sort of painted black, and there was something about the film. And the combination of the whole, so it wasn't just in that case it wasn't necessary to put the projector in the cinema. He thought the whole room was part of the apparatus.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah,
yeah. Now we are running slightly out of time, so perhaps we should refer to your forthcoming screening.
Yes.
So this is Nicky Hamlin at London Wilton's Music Hall, and it is on Tuesday the 16th of June, as part of Reverberations number 4, organised by Nowhere. And it says, in the fourth edition of our Reverberation series, presented as part of Cut and Splice Living Rooms, UK artist and writer Nicky Hamlin will critique his locational approach to filmmaking through a talk film screening and a new expanded film sound performance with Connor Kelly. Got a few minutes. Can you describe roughly what's going to happen on the evening?
Or? Yeah, there'll be a programme of room films, so-called room films, which three of my films, the Godal film that we talked about earlier, and another film called Anterior Interior by Vincent Grenier, who's a French-Canadian, lives in New York, filmmaker whose work is very interesting. And he made a kind of transition from film to video, so the video work's completely different. So it would be that film by him, and then a piece by Connor called Source, which kind of investigates, it's a digital piece, digital video, but it kind of investigates synchronization, the nature of the synchronization relationship between sound and image, and where is the source of the sound, as it were. Those kind of questions come into that work.
Right.
So that piece kind of sets up the... then I'll do a talk. I'll talk about that work for 20 minutes, maybe half an hour. And then we're going to do a live performance, which involves some pre-recorded sound and filmed film, which will be processed on the day. And that'll be running... That film will be running as a loop. And then the performance in the evening will involve shooting a little bit more film with a Bolex Clockwork 16mm camera, developing that on stage and then projecting it alongside the previously shot material. So there'll be two film projectors running two loops of 16mm black and white. They'll just be negative images. And then we'll have this mixture of pre-recorded sound and live sound, but all the material sourced within the space. So it's a kind of site-conditioned, if you to use the jargon, site-conditioned piece of work.
Okay.
And the whole thing's a sort of an hour and a half to 2 hours long.
Right. So this is Wilton's Music Hall.
Yeah, it's in Great Grace's Alley, which is off Ensign Street, E1.
Okay, and that is 7 o'clock next Tuesday.
Yep.
Tuesday the...
And it's free.
And it's free, but booking apparently is essential.
Yeah.
So how do you go to the Nowhere website or something?
Yeah, and the address is info@now-w-here.org.uk. I think I've got that right.
I think you've missed out a W, actually.
Have
it's now. It's like now here, isn't it?
Yeah, now.
Anyway.
Yeah. If you go on their website, I'm sure you can find a link to the to book that.
The Nowhere website.
Mm.
And speaking of which, we could round off with this. I'm going to play a bit of this record, which is by Touch 7. And this is a track by Karen Mirza and Brad Butler. On a 45 RPM vinyl, which we can finish up with. Thank you very much to Nicky Hamlin, filmmaker, for coming in.
Thank you.
We could actually do about 6 programmes with you talking about your films. It's sort of, we could have gone on and on, but there we are. I'll just thank you.
No.